I want to introduce you to a text that I translated from the Kagong Sutra. This is what we can call the formless stanza. Formless verse. Are you all familiar with it? The stanza is there's quite a few verses, and we won't be able to talk about all of them, but we'll understand. I'll talk about the gist of them and pick a few to talk about this morning. So I'll read it for you first. We'll see which one you'd like to hear. And the text goes, when one's thorough understanding of the teaching is on par with a thorough penetration of the mind, then that is like the sun in the vast sky. What is transmitted is only this dharma of seeing the nature, which transcends the world and shatters erroneous views. In this dharma, there is neither sudden nor gradual. In delusion and awakening, there is slowness and quickness. The gate of seeing one's nature is that which the ignorant cannot fathom. Although there are 1,000 ways to describe it, if they correspond with the principle, they all return to one. Within the darkness dwelling of vexations, one must always generate the sun of wisdom. Ordinarily, when erroneous views emerge, vexations follow. When the correct views arise, vexations are eradicated. But when neither erroneous nor correct views are engaged, purity reaches no remainder. No remainder is a technical word for nirvana. Bodhi is fundamentally our self-nature. But to generate a thought is a delusion. The mind of purity exists in delusion. The upright and the three obstructions will be absent. If worldly people practice the way, nothing will obstruct them. Always recognize your own faults, and you will be in accordance with the way. All forms have their own ways. They do not hinder one another. But to seek the way apart from the way, you will never see the way. Passing your whole life through its ups and downs, you will cause yourself grief. If you want to see the true way, be upright is the way. If you have no mind for the way, you will walk in darkness and will not see it. If you are a genuine person of the way, then you will not see the faults of the world. If you see the wrongs of others, yourself are also wrong. If you consider others wrong, but you are not, then your wrong is itself a transgression. Just discard this fault-finding mind, and vexations will be destroyed. When your mind is not captivated by aversion and craving, you can then stretch out your legs and rest. If you wish to transform others, it must have expedient means. Not creating doubt in others is itself the manifestation of self-nature. But the Dharma pervades the world and cannot be realized apart from the world. Seeking Bodhi apart from the world is just like looking for the horns on a hare. Correct view is called world transcending. Incorrect view belongs to this world. When the incorrect and correct are both cast aside, the nature of Bodhi is self-apparent. These verses are the sun teaching, which is also called the vehicle of the great Dharma. Confused to what you're hearing will lead to eons of suffering. But awakening itself occurs instantaneously. Nice verses, how they relate to our life. The gist of these verses come from Platform Sutra. It's the main message, and that is see one's self nature. Chan cannot be understood as a complete path. Chan is not a complete path. So if taken out of context, then problems will come up. And we have already seen problems in the development of American Buddhism. Why is it not a complete path? Because it arose as a movement in response, in reaction to the traditional foundations of Buddhism. So, what it seeks to transmit can be said to be the pinnacle of the development of Buddhism. Right? The most essential part, like a pyramid, the top part. It doesn't cover the basic foundation. It's assumed that people already have foundation. So it presents itself as what I've said on Friday night. Some of you weren't here at the Pure Mind Center. It's a path of recognition as opposed to the path of transformation. Traditional Buddhism presents us a path of transforming our erroneous ways in body, speech, and mind. Purify, provides us methods so we can change ourselves. Basically, it's a path from A to B. We walk this path, we have to first recognize where we are, recognize our mechanism, our patterns of thinking, and wish to change ourselves. So the Buddha taught suffering and the cause. cause of suffering. And that there is a way out. There is a possibility for a cessation. So the Four Noble Truths. This is a path of transformation. Transforming ourselves from A to B. So this is the foundation of Buddha Dharma. In the process of transforming ourselves, sometimes people can get caught up with all the different methods, all the different approaches, the different traditions. Even after the Buddha passed away, about 100 years after he passed away, there's already 18 to 20 different sects, schools. This is even before the emergence of the Mahayana tradition. So by the first century BCE, there was a whole array of traditions of Buddhism, very complex. Each one espousing its own antidote, approaches to practice. And sometimes it can get confusing without proper guidance, without sticking to a path, when people shop around. When one does not have a teacher. So it can become confusing. And all of these teachings emerge in response to particular circumstances of sentient beings, particular needs of the time. So there are different paths. And when it was transmitted to China, it basically came randomly. Not in a complete package, not received wholesale. Came with different levels of teaching, decontextualized. So on the receiving end of the Chinese, very confusing. So they had to develop a system to process this, which is called doctrinal classification, panjiao. All this is very fascinating for the Chinese, so they got very involved in the doctrinal theories. Once they finally figured out what the Buddha has taught, the Buddha's teaching, all of which were expedient means, all of the lineage masters who developed it, further elaborate on them, basically responding to circumstances. And there is no fixed teaching. And in that context, Chan emerged as a path to point out the essential meaning of the Buddha. The reason Buddhas appear in the world. Buddhism, of course, was primarily a monastic practice. I did not have to address the vicissitudes of life, the challenges within the cloisters. The challenge was itself a response to the needs of the time and the people. And primarily, people were lay. So, it pointed to the essential key teachings of the Dharma, so that it can be made very accessible to the needs of the people, and bring it down from the clouds to make it down to earth, so people can actually apply it in their daily life. It's a very different thing when something is developed and has a long history. There's no need to explain to justify its existence. For example, Buddhism has been developed 500-600 years in India before it went to China. There's no need to justify anymore. When a teaching comes to a new region, we have to justify its existence. Especially the new civilization is on par, at least it perceives itself as on par with Indian. Right? If the new civilization doesn't even have a language system, you know, maybe a less sophisticated system, then in the pattern of the history of Buddhism, we see, basically it just takes over. It just takes over. Right? Because Buddhism is a very sophisticated system, hierarchical, very structured, different levels of path. There's Buddhist psychology, thousands of years old, Buddhist epistemology, and the path of practice, soteriology, different. So it's a very system, very structured. Whenever it goes to a new civilization that's kind of lesser sophistication, such as, for example, around 300 BCE, first transmission to South Asia, basically just takes over. Why? They don't even have a language. They don't even have a written language, let alone sophistication of Buddhism. And Buddhism arose out of India, which has a millennium of practices of astrology, language, mathematics, all the sciences, so it basically just takes over. But when Buddhism came to the second transmission to China, China has two millenniums of language development already, pre-BCE time. It has a system of governance. It has its own soteriological path, path of liberation, indigenous traditions. So then we see negotiation, we see conflict, we see change. We see the need for the Dharma to justify itself, why there's a need for you to practice this. Right? And then it goes to Korea. In Japan. Yeah. By the time we went to Korea, Buddhism already 500 years in China. Yeah. To Japan, already 600 years, 700 years. So, the last transmission in pre-modern time, it goes to Tibet. No written language. This is a civilization of no written language. Buddhism basically just takes over. Right? The last phase of Buddhist development in India, right? When Tantra already arose, mixed with indigenous practices, goes to Tibet, and basically takes over. It's the same civilization in terms of writing. But Tibet was very unique. Tibet was in contact with not only India, but also China. So he received both transmissions. The middle period of Chan history, that is during the period of 9th century, 8th century, that period of development of Chan went to Tibet, mixed with indigenous practices. Later on, it was developed into practices such as Dzogchen, Mahamudra. So, also one of the highest teachings in the Tibetan tradition. So Chan does not present itself as a complete path. Decontextualized, all kinds of problems will come. And that's what the text says. When one's thorough understanding of a teaching is on par with thorough penetration of the mind, then it is like the sun in the vast sky. And what is transmitted is only this Dharma of seeing the nature, which transcends the world and shatters erroneous views. Now, as we recall, Chan was a reactionary movement against basically scholastic Buddhism. Nothing wrong with scholastic Buddhism. It was very much needed, because how Buddhism came to China was basically random. All the structures of teaching didn't come wholesale. It came in a very random way. So the Chinese had to devise and theorize and really understand what the Dharma was about. Systematize it, structure it. But when that becomes too evolved, sometimes it compromises the need to actually experience the Dharma. So Chan was merely suggesting, hello, don't lose sight of that which is most important, okay? What is only transmitted here is seeing the nature. So it presents itself as a path of recognition as opposed to transformation. Transforming from A to B, this path. It's the same, and it's also different than the path of recognition. If we don't have the correct views when we engage in the path of transformation, then we really think we're getting something, and we're getting somewhere, and we're shedding something, we're rejecting something, we're getting rid of something. And that something is, we're gaining enlightenment, gaining better understanding, and getting rid of our vexations. So the point of Chan is to point to that awakening and delusion have the same nature. Gaining and losing does not increase or decrease this true nature. The analogy that I usually give is like the spaciousness of this room. The true nature of this room is spaciousness, openness. Of course, we can put partitions up. We can put walls up. Or we can put all kind of furniture like the cushions. But that doesn't really affect the nature of the room. Right? So, the nature of the room is openness. That makes sense? But when people come into the room, they usually get caught up with the furniture. They don't see a spacious room. They just see the room is a mess. They think, oh, I gotta get rid of it. The room is clean. I say, oh, now I feel good. It's spacious. So that's what this passage is responding to. Gaining and losing, cleaning and filth. Nirvana, samsara. Right? If we practice with correct views, no gaining, no losing, which is actually expounded everywhere in the Dharma, in the scriptures. Right? It's everywhere in the scriptures. It doesn't matter if it's the Agamas or the Nikayas or Mahayana scriptures. It's actually pervasive. But when one kind of get caught up with the tedious complex structure of the teaching that we want to get lost. One may be able to articulate it, but when vexations come without genuine practice, they still want to get rid of vexations. They still wish this moment to be other than what it is, which is what the Buddha said is suffering. Suffering is wish this moment to be other than what it is, basically. When we wish this to be other than what it is, then within this here and now, there's already grasping the other and rejecting, I don't want this. So, craving, aversion, stemming out of ignorance. Three poisons of the mind. This is basic Dharma 101. Three poisons pervades, for most people, every aspect of their life. All of their decisions, judgments, opinions. When something accords with me, I like. It doesn't accord with me, I don't like. In the midst of this mechanism of the three poisons of wanting this moment to be other than what it is, which is grasping and rejecting, standing out from the mental universe. In the midst of this, there's a very fundamental assumption, misunderstanding, that lies at the core, and that is self-attachment. Three poisons of the mind, craving, aversion, and ignorance, can only exist based around an assumption of something permanent, a self. And the self is absent. Three poisons cannot exist. Cannot. It's just inoperative. So this self-referentiality, something that's permanent, separate, independent. Of course, the text talks about thorough understanding of teaching. Maybe articulation. You have to understand this. And that's the foundation. But what is necessary is thorough penetration of mind. Otherwise, we can articulate it, we can teach it to ourselves, to others, and then we still have kind of problem within ourselves. So we have not understood our mind. Then Chan has a problem with that. You see, Chan might highlight this point. See the self nature. See the self nature, so you know the true nature of all kinds of furniture in this room. Maybe they don't get caught up in the process of cleaning up this room. It doesn't say, after you see your self nature, there's no need to clean anymore. Your life can live whatever you want. It doesn't say that. So it's not a complete path. It just points out the essential of the path. See true nature, and then when you clean, when you interact with the world, everything becomes part of your practice. And you won't engage in discriminating, judging. You won't engage in the process of craving, rejecting all of this fundamental ignorance. Does that make sense? Do you still respond to the world? Yes. Is there a need for civil law? Yes. Is there a need for right and wrong? Yes. But the right and wrong no longer rest on the basis of your own self-referentiality. We don't misidentify opinions, consensus, law, right, wrong with our true nature. You wouldn't identify the furniture with the room, would you? So, all the furnitures are very useful. In fact, free from the labeling of what is a good furniture, what is a bad furniture, if one can be free from that and see them as furniture, one can see the full potential of every furniture. In fact, even those furniture that's broken down, not so helpful, can become recycled. You can see potential. Can be reused. But if we label something fixed as this or that, then we kill the potential of that thing. So if we see, something as table, this is only a table. But it has potential to be a chair. A stand, I can stand on it and change light bulbs or do all kinds of stuff. So, this is a misunderstanding, right? A misidentification. But most of us are trained to be this way. We're conditioned this way. So we take what we think, how we feel, as ourselves. Like the furniture. These fabrications, constructs of the mind, discursive thinking, like we said during the retreat, papanka, right? Speculations. They are what we project onto the world, and how we project it based on complex series of interaction of dependent origination. What we've learned, how we feel, what we're taught, how we interact with others, all these are kind of mixed into a particular formula which we assume to be my opinion, my view. But actually, your opinion comes with everything else. So, just grasping onto this, let me project onto that world out there, and then problems come. That's where suffering comes. So, speculation, concepts, words and language, in themselves, not the problem. We need that. We need language, we need words, we need rules and conduct, we need right and wrong to help us to navigate through life, to help provide safety, harmony for everyone. But attached to this problem. Does that make sense?
Mm.
So, when one's thorough understanding the teaching, which means we have to thoroughly understand the teachings, that's the first step, okay? And don't get caught up with the minutiae. Some people get caught up with my teachings. It's better than that teaching. But this tradition, that's lost. So thorough understanding of teaching is on par with thorough penetration of the mind. One must experience the nature of mind. And Chan has his particular views. This retreat is silent illumination. And the key to silent illumination is to free ourselves from the key juncture, the crux, the essence of that misunderstanding. What is that? Papanka. Distinguish between fabrications, speculation, conceptualization with how things actually are. And so you sit. The reason just sit. Shikantaza. Because when you sit, you just mind your business. At least mind this business of sitting, this act of sitting. Everything that arises, let it go. That's not what is actually happening in the present. And what is actually happening here is body sitting, mind sitting. That's what's actually happening. So learn in the simplified space of just sitting without being conditioned by clutter. this will lead to other areas of life in which when you engage with other people, when you talk, you are just being there. And what needs to be done, how to respond, you will not be caught up with the fabrications. You can freely use what's needed to respond to people, to help others, without identifying with them as this is me or mine. So only then that's like the sun in the vast sky, empty sky. Yeah. Wonderful, right? Sun, darkness dispelled. Yeah. The sun in the sky is, of course, is a metaphor for our true nature. But in terms of practice, we have to have confidence and faith that, yes, the sun is originally there. At least in this galaxy, right? We don't know what happened before. That is our true nature, is originally here. There's nothing to do to correct, to manipulate, to make the sun form, existing, to bring it into existence. It's already here. And that points to the spacious, original nature of this world. It's already here. We have to learn to see it. You see? We have to recognize it. And Chan provides this path of recognition. If the sun is not something that we already have, and then we have to get, that means it can be lost. That means it belongs to the world of furnitures. Coming and going, getting and losing, grasping and rejecting. That's not the sun. Does that make sense? The sun is something already here. But we are usually caught up with furniture. That's like being caught up with the weather. You know, cloudy days. We can't see the sun. Sun, what are you talking about? This is no sun. What I experience in my life is not sun. What I experience is just clouds and storms and this and that. So we have to first have faith that there's sun. How to have faith? It's not blind faith. We have faith from practice. The Buddha Dharma provides faith from practice. By using the method. When we use the method of practice and we engage with it, inevitably something will happen. Because it's the true nature of clouds and the storm to just go away. We see a beam of light. The sun really exists. You know? So we have, based on practice, we begin to have experience of faith in oneself. The sun. And this will be analogous to when we're very vexed. We learn meditation, we practice, and we actually feel peace. The storm is not here in this brief moment. Then we can think, well, if we continue to practice, it's also possible to experience this again and again and again. Right? So, faith in oneself. When we have faith in oneself, through personal engagement with the practice, then we will have faith in the method, the Dharma. See? And we will have faith in the community of practitioners who transmits the Dharma, the Sangha. And Sangha is instituted by the Buddha. So, three jewels. Three jewels, in other words, faith in the three jewels is different than the three jewels Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. It's different than other world religions, which you just believe in the words, and have faith. Faith is your salvation. Faith is salvation. From Buddha Dharma is the entry to salvation. But from Buddha Dharma, it's through the Dharma. From the Dharma, from the engagement in practice, we have faith in oneself, we have faith in the Sangha, we have faith in Buddha. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. The more we engage in practice, the more confidence, conviction we have. And then faith, eventually in Buddhism, is transformed to wisdom. Becomes your personal experience. So faith, we say, faith can enter, wisdom delivers. Faith allows us to enter, wisdom delivers. Whose wisdom? Our own wisdom. It transforms. So, when we engage in practice, we have glimpses of the potential for the storm in our life to dissipate. And we begin to have confidence. Right? Natural. In ourselves that we can, right? We can actually do it. The storm is actually impermanent. And this method really works. Even though it's only for 2 minutes. But it works. So if I practice more, maybe we can make it part of our life. Then, from the perspective of practice, the sun in the vast empty sky. And that's why Huinen said, what is transmitted here is this. Only this Dharma, this teaching of seeing self-nature, the sun, which transcends the world and shatters erroneous views. Transcending the world here refers to not really leaving the world. And later on the text talks about the Buddha Dharma can only be practiced here. It's not even leaving the world. It means it goes beyond the furniture. It goes beyond the storm. You actually see the sun. You see our full potential as a human being. Our potential to be free. And the sun is just an analogy for that which is originally free within us. The unconditioned. The unborn. And as our liturgy says, the deathless. And for that reason, the text says, in this Dharma, there is neither sudden nor gradual. In delusion and awakening, however, there is slowness and there is quickness. That's our identity, our grasping. To what extent we are conditioned, wired into prapanka, the fabrication, the speculation, our constructs. To what extent we are kind of tied into that. That determines how slow, quickly we can dispel the clouds and see the sun. But the sun has nothing to do with gradual or sudden. Does that make sense? Like the spaciousness of this room, that has nothing to do with how big the walls are, you know, how tall the partitions are, how we divide them. That's how we do it. Is there a gradualness and suddenness in terms of the spaciousness of the room? It's already all at once here. But our glasses, maybe if our glasses are very foggy, or then we can't see space, or if we're kind of conditioned to look at furniture, then we don't see space. All we see is just the clutter. All we see is just things, objects. And we're taught to get objects and to get rid of some other objects because that one's better. So all we're involved in is use our hands to grasp this and rejecting that. No one has taught us that. To open the grasping hand to just see, like, what the hell is grasping? You know? So that's easy to understand, right? If we don't understand, if we confuse the true nature with the appearance of things, then it will be hard to fathom this. And it is hard to fathom, isn't it? It's hard to fathom because everywhere we look, we are surrounded by forms and sounds. And everyone we know is involved in this process, what appears to be a process of getting certain form, trying to get rid of some other. This whole matrix, this world functions this way. And all of us are plugged in. Maybe you have seen a movie, Matrix. It's like all of us are plugged in, so it's hard to believe that it's not. This is not what it seems. So the message of the Dharma is to see through the veil, because if we are plugged into that 100%, then we're not living out our full potential. Worst, precisely because we are completely plugged in and have no autonomy, we experience suffering. This is not too hard to understand. We just go to some store, you know, some grocery store, go to the magazine stand. And that will make you feel sad. For people that are plugged in, the degree of their suffering, their anguish, their sadness, is totally, totally determined by the mechanism of what is good, what is bad, what is ideal, what is not good. You know? What an ideal man should look like, what an ideal woman should look like. You know? What an ideal house should look like. You know? A lot of bling bling. You know? What this is, so it's almost not for humans. In case the models in the magazines are not humans, we have something to make them look our ideal, which is Photoshop. Let's shave off a little bit here and make it a little rounder over there. So let's just make it a little less human. So, and then that determines our happiness. We have to go too far. We have to go too far. And so, in delusion and awakening, delusion and awakening, awakening from that, there is definitely slowness and gradual or quickness. But as for the true nature, there's no such thing. Already perfect. Replete. There was a Zen master, 20th century. I greatly admire him. He passed away in the 80s. Morinaga Roshi. He became a monk, basically he thought that monks are useless and there's nothing useful for his life, so he just became a monk. But he has his reasons. World War II, he studied Western philosophy in Japan. Young man. Existentialism, phenomenology, all this. Great. And then the war broke out. Everything chucked outside the window. Everything, all the philosophy just went right outside the window. Why? He's drafted. Oh my goodness. You know? He's drafted. You know, they're running out of soldiers, so okay, young people. 15 and above. Anyone? So think about all your philosophy and I'm going to war. Everything's just out the window. And luckily the war ended before he actually went. You know, so he's like, but he lost everything. His family, his house, everything. So he thought it was useless. So he's walking past this monastery, small monastery. Nothing meaningful. What is the meaning of life? When people die and live the way they do, and all of my learnings, my long possession, the family, everything is gone. What is the meaning of this? They walk past the temples, small temples. Useless, I'll just become a monk. He's very lucky because he walked right past one of the largest Rinzai training temples, ex-abbot, small temple, a retired abbot's temple, Zuigo Roshi. This small man, very fortunate, he went to that temple to become a monk. So he goes to Nagantoi. Zuigo Roshi, you know, the small guy, what do you want? This old man, retired Zen master. He says, I want to become a monk. How many of you know the story? He says, I want to become a monk. I said, why? Why do you want to become a monk? Because my life is worthless. I'm worthless. Meaningless. So Zuigo Roshi, life is meaningless, that's why you want to become a monk. Okay, go look in the garden. Look in the garden. Put the twigs in one pile, the leaves in one pile, and all the pebbles in one pile. So he's okay, that's what I'm doing. Young man sweeping. He studied philosophy. He put everything in one big pile. Says, I'm done. What do you want me to do with this garbage? Zuigo Roshi took a look at it. Twigs in one pile, leaves in one pile, I said the pebbles in one pile. But it's worthless. Zuigo Roshi goes over there. Start to pick all the twigs out, and he's just watching this old man. And then says, in the one corner there's a bathhouse. So put the leaf, you'll see some leaves in the basket. Put it all there. We use that to start the fire. Says, okay. Twigs, the small one, different sizes. We use that to sustain the fire. Mm-hmm. And he's looking at the pebbles, like, that must be garbage, right? I said, okay, took all the pebbles. He walked to a certain part of the garden that has an indentation. He knows exactly where the garden is. So he tapped down all the small rocks to fill the holes, everything. And then Zrika Roshi turned to him and says, there's nothing in the world that's useless, worthless. At that moment, Moinaraj knelt down, tears. That was his first lesson in Zen. All the furniture is useful. But if you get caught up with this is good and that is bad, you lose track. You simply want to get rid of that and want to get this. So, what have we learned this morning? Something that we already have, right? The sun. There's what?
Nothing.
There's nothing useless. Even the way we respond to storm, bad weather covering the sun, very useful. That's what the text says. I'll finish with this one line and let you all resonate with what we do. Or walking.
No, I'm sitting.
I'm sitting, okay. Massage a little bit, and we will sit. And I will give a little guided meditation to settle the mind, settle the body. And we can practice the silent determination method of just sitting. The method of just sitting accords perfectly with what I have been saying, the formless verse. So let's first establish a good foundation in sitting. And the foundation is a relaxed body and mind. So place your hands on your knees. yourself fully here. Feeling the sounds of the environment. You are here. Commit yourself to completely being here. Now draw in your sense experiences. Bring it back from the environment to your body. Bring your awareness to the crown of your head. And relax. Not conceptually, but through sensations, feelings. From the crown of the head flowing down to our forehead region. The space between your eyes, your eyebrows. Make sure that area is relaxed. Can you raise your eyebrows and let them drop? Raise your eyebrows again, let them drop. Familiarize yourself with what it feels like to relax that area of the body. Relax your eyeballs now. This means do not close your eyes. If you see color, even darkness, you are still using your eyes. Do not use your eyes. For the time being, close your eyes, close your eyelids. Feel the sensation of relaxation. Relax your cheeks, lips, mouth, teeth closed, tongue to the upper palate, chin tucked in. Make sure your face is relaxed. Now go back to the top of the head, the crown, and let it flow down from there to the back of the head, the cranium. Scalp. Flow down your neck. Relax. Down to the two shoulders. At this time, you can raise your shoulders and let them drop. Or move your shoulders a bit just to familiarize yourself what it is like to have relaxed shoulders. Raise it up, let them drop. Flow down two arms, biceps, triceps, elbows. Forearms. Wrists. Feel the warmth of your palms on your knees, the back of the hand and fingers. Now the two arms are relaxed. Now the chest. Relaxing the chest. Exhale, relaxing the abdomen, upper, middle, and lower abdomen. There's a gentle rise and fall of the abdomen. That means it is relaxed. Shoulders, in the shoulder blades, mid back, lower back, and the buttocks. At this time, sway your body from left to right to find the center point. Sometimes when we relax, we're actually leaning to one side without knowing it. And front and back. Just so we identify the center point and then relax into it. Once you find this, relaxing into it. At the buttocks, we feel stability, sense of weight here. Allow the sense of weight to sink down to earth, leaving your upper body light as a feather. No tension, burden whatsoever. Let it sink down. Connected to earth. Continuing on. Hips, thighs, and knees. Relaxing them. Main calves, your small leg, ankles, and feet. Now double check from head to toe, are you relaxed? 3 points in particular, the eyes region, the shoulders, and the abdomen. Once these 3 points are relaxed, your sense of body weight will be able to settle down, leaving you grounded, stable. At this point, place your hand in a meditation posture, left on top of right, two thumbs slightly touching. Sitting upright, with dignity. In meditation practice, there are three aspects. The foundation is relaxation. The breath must be natural, and the mind must be clear. The three keys are method, having a method, having a technique, and the right attitude. With the method, for those of you who have not gone on this retreat, you may use the breath, being aware of the in and out of your breath. The technique is the focus on sensation, cool, warmth, silky sensation, of course, long or short. The changing sensations and the attitude is that of appreciation. It is the attitude that frames the experience of meditation. It is something that we must cultivate, so bring forth this appreciation. Great interest in this moment, this moment's sensation. For those of you using the silent illumination method, the method, technique, and attitude is thus. Method, the first stage, just sitting. Technique, feeling grounded, rooted in this simplicity of sitting. That is your method to ground you in the sitting. You can focus on the technique of your posture. The relaxed body. Or the sense of presence. That is your bodily weight. The base. These three will concretely ground you in this act of sitting. Body sitting, mind sitting. This is the practice of just sitting. Shikang Taza. Staying with the simplicity of this here. Body sitting, mind sitting. And the attitude can also be the same. Appreciation. Great fascination. Or you can use what was said yesterday. Great contentment. Nothing to lose, nothing to gain. You're already replete. The prapanka, speculation, discursive thinking, wandering thoughts, does not define you. The simple act of just sitting here with dignity, contentment, no gain, no loss. This is the expression of your true nature. So we continue to sit.